Hey, folks. All right. I'm in the studio. I'm getting my mic set up. Sorry about this. All right. We're ready. Let's go ahead and start. Welcome back to Art Pod. I'm your host, Kate Wells, and this is the podcast that rounds up the news about music, books, movies, culture, and yes, you guessed it, art in Michigan. And this week, your kids went back to school. You started a new year at college, maybe, or like me, you just said a very, very sad goodbye to summer and a big hello to the return of football season. Here at Michigan Radio, our arts desk is heading into a very happily busy fall. We've got lots of gallery openings, new movies, concerts, and today I want to tell you about a new musical, a murder mystery, and a different look at Motown. To kick it off, we're going to start here in Ann Arbor. A new play just wrapped up its showing. It's written by Alex Kipp. He's a Michigan grad. He's 26 now. But when he was 22 and a musical theater major, he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The play that he's written is about that experience and not just the personal and emotional tribulations that you go through if when you're 22 and you have cancer. But it also raises this issue of young adult cancer patients in general. If you're like me, you had no idea that these patients are the only group whose survival rates are not getting better when it comes to cancer treatments. And Alex finds an interesting way of dealing with that. Let's go ahead and take a listen. The play is called My Other Voice, and yes, it is about cancer, but it's also about falling in love, even when sudden bleeding interrupts your smooth moves.
Call the nurse! No, it's coming out of your port! No, what if something's wrong?
And it's about stoned debates about God.
Maybe God's the only voice I have left.
Or maybe God is the true placenta effect.
And on a related note, it is also about pot brownies, lots and lots of pot brownies. Basically, it's what cancer looks like when you're 22. It begins when lead character Alex Kipp, played by now 26-year-old real-life Alex Kipp, loses his voice right before the most important auditions of his college career.
Because I'm like nothing in the world!
That's never happened before.
The voice loss is explained when Alex is diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Basically, a tumor the size of a sheet of paper is pressing against his lungs.
In a weird way, I wasn't even thinking about the cancer. I was thinking, oh, so that's why I've been having vocal issues. So now I can get better. Now my voice will come back, in
People
a sense.
You're going to hear that and be like, that's crazy.
It is crazy. When that is your life, when that sort of is who you are, you feel like you've already died in some sense.
And this is all part of the point that Kipp is trying to make with this play, that depression and anxiety hit young adult cancer patients differently than they do kids or older adult patients.
Knowing that all my friends are off in New York, auditioning, graduating, doing all this stuff, and you're sort of the one who's left behind. You know, you're sort of the one who has to move back in with your parents. You have to leave all those aspirations. And you have to literally just put it on pause.
Kipp stresses that he was one of the more fortunate ones. He had his family, he had friends, not to mention affordable insurance. But there was one thing he didn't find until after all of the chemo and radiation, other young adult patients like him.
Test. This is Matthew Zachary, founder and CEO of StupidCancer.org, a nonprofit organization committed to improving the quality of life for young adults affected by cancer. That's my NPR voice.
Matthew Zachary was diagnosed with cancer when he was 19. Now he has built StupidCancer.org to give young patients a community. They're just 6% of all cancer diagnoses every year. But cancer is still one of the biggest killers of people 15 to 39. And unlike kids or seniors, their survival rates are not getting any better. Zachary says the reasons are complicated, but three things are pretty clear.
We're finding that many young adults are diagnosed late stage. Number two is the fact that young adults don't really identify with self-risk. You're entitled to be invincible when you're 19 years old. And the third reason is we're looking at a significant percentage of them that go unaware of peer support and age-appropriate resources.
What that means is that going from being the only young guy in a cancer ward to being part of a digital army can actually improve your chances of surviving. For Alex Kipp, finding people like Matthew Zachary and the StupidCancer.org community, they are part of the reason he wrote this play, not just to run it here in Ann Arbor, but to take it to as many college campuses as he can.
Though you feel like you're the only young adult who's ever had cancer, you know, you realize that there are a lot. and there are a lot of survivors. And for me, it was like, well, if these people can make a difference, then why can't I?
My Other Voice runs through this weekend. I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
We are blessed.
All right, next, on a completely different note, we are going to head over to Battle Creek. There, the mystery of who killed Daisy Zick has been on the minds of police and residents of Battle Creek since 1963. Though at least three people caught a glimpse of her killer, no one has ever been brought to justice for the crime. The writer of a new book called Murder in Battle Creek sat down to talk about this mystery with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Who killed Daisy Zick? That question has been in the minds of police and residents of Battle Creek ever since January 14, 1963. That's when someone murdered Daisy Zick in her home. Hard to believe, but no one has ever been brought to justice for this murder, even though at least three people caught a glimpse of the killer. Writer Blaine Pardo's latest book is called Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick. Blaine Pardo joins us now in the studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, reading about this case, I have to say, Blaine, is like watching a real-life CSI Battle Creek. It really has so many layers.
It's fascinating, too, because, you know, you mentioned CSI. We all are kind of seduced by television and what it tells us about, oh, all the sophisticated techniques for analyzing evidence. But, you know, in 1963, you dealt with true police work, what we would call gumshoe type work, mm-hmm. where they worked their leads, they worked, you know, interviewing techniques, things along those lines, which is really how a lot of cases get solved. I know we all like watching it on television and get pulled into that, but it's, to me, it's real police work, and that's fun.
They didn't have the advantage of a lot of the scientific breakthroughs, DNA testing and things that we take for granted today.
Oh, true. Even in speaking with a lot of the surviving officers, and it's hard after five decades, mm-hmm. you know, there's not a lot of them left. You know, the training that officers used to get for homicide work in 1963 was around 8 to 16 hours worth of training for it. Now it's weeks worth of training.
Sure.
On it. So, you know, techniques have improved over time.
Well, tell us, who was Daisy Zick?
You know, Daisy was a really interesting character in Battle Creek, and she was born in 1919. She was married at the age of 14. She lived outside of Battle Creek on a farm in Assyria Township in Michigan. She was married in 19, had an abusive husband, ended up divorced with one child. And her parents helped raise that child, and she went to work full-time along with her sister in Battle Creek working in the cereal industry, which is kind of the heart and soul of Battle Creek.
Working for Kellogg's was like someone in Detroit working for Ford, Chrysler, or GM, wasn't it?
Yeah, and she ended up working at Kellogg's, which Kellogg's is kind of interesting. Like any major corporation, it has mm-hmm. its own little culture within itself, its own society within itself, and Daisy fit right into this. She was very well liked, very personable. She worked on a job that was on a production line that was very much out in public. So anyone walking through knew Daisy within the factory, small community. Daisy did have several affairs in her tenure there at Kellogg's. You know, there's been a lot of rumors over the years that Daisy had a lot of affairs. I was only able to really track down about three of them. Well, as one officer put to me, though, when someone dies, everyone becomes a saint, you know. But Daisy was well-liked and well-respected, but someone apparently had a very sincere grudge against her.
So take us through her last day.
Oh, I'd love to. It was January 14th, 1963. Mm-hmm. They always tell you as an author, never open with the weather, but I have to. It was cold. It was below zero, snowing. There had been snow days before. As well, Daisy worked the afternoon shift. Her husband left for work. She was going to go meet with a friend for lunch and then go work the afternoon shift at Kellogg's. Never showed up.
Okay.
And her husband went to look for her, found her car abandoned about a mile and a half from their house on East Michigan Avenue, which is one of the most heavily traveled thoroughfares in Calhoun County. Went home and found her dead. She had been – the phone line had been cut in their house. She had had a struggle in both the kitchen and in their bedroom. Apparently, someone had tied her hands behind her back and had begun stabbing her in the bedroom, and Daisy fought back.
Wow. Even with her hands tied.
Even with her hands tied, she had made her way to the back bedroom where someone had continued to stab her. She had slid down the wall, and then whoever this was had known her well enough, they straddled her body and continued to stab her, inflicting over 27 stab wounds and a bludgeon wound behind her ear, broke her ribs, and used what was what we would call a utility knife, but at Kellogg's they were called spoilage knives. They were used to kind of cut open cardboard boxes, etc. That's believed to be the murder weapon.
Did they find a murder weapon, or was that deduced from the wounds?
Well, they found it in her sink. Daisy had a spoilage knife that she used to cut chicken with. Mm-hmm. They found traces of blood on it. They're not sure whether it was human blood or chicken blood. There wasn't a large enough sample for them to verify. But whoever it was did not drive to Daisy's house. Whoever it was, there was no car seen there, but the person had been seen from some distance away at her door. So whoever went there very deliberately on the coldest day of the year.
Mm. Walking.
Walking or had been dropped off. And they abandoned her car on a major thoroughfare.
Mm-hmm.
And either they had a car waiting for them or someone picked them up.
This gruesome murder is the subject of the book Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick. And don't worry, this wasn't recent. This happened 50 years ago, January 14th, 1963. And writer Blaine Pardo has put this all together. And amazing to think that in these five decades, no one's been brought to justice. Yet, as you point out in your book, Blaine, people saw the killer, correct?
Well, absolutely. Fred Ritchie of the Calhoun County Sheriff's Department was running late, taking a prisoner to court, and drove by the person walking in front of Daisy Zick's car. He didn't know there had been a murder at that point. And he made a mental note, if I come back and see this person walk along the road, I'll give him a ride. 1963, you picked up hitchhikers.
You did.
She was seen – the killer was as well seen by the neighbor, Mrs. DeFrance, who looked over and at about – 50 yards, 80 yards distance, saw the killer at Daisy's door, but no vehicle. And later, two more witnesses came forward. One came forward 2 months later with a very accurate description of the killer. He had been following Daisy's car as it was abandoned and was so angry at the person for driving slow, he kind of looked over to glare at the person and made eye contact with the killer. Another person came forward 4 years later and said, I had also seen that person, but unfortunately so much time had passed and so much of the emphasis of the investigation had been on Kellogg's itself and that small, tight-knit community.
And that must have, in turn, because so many people in Battle Creek worked there, that must have really hit the community hard.
It really did. Daisy had a reputation, whether it was rightfully earned or not. I try not to go there, because that we don't know the details of all that. But you have to bear in mind what the police looked at was a very vague description of a man at the door. So the first place they looked was where Daisy worked. So if you skipped work that day, this was a horrible day to skip work. Picture, if you will, the police showing up at your door and saying, we want to talk to you about the murder of Daisy Zick. You'd actually just maybe skipped out to have drinks with your friends. And can you imagine how much marital strife that caused if your wife is sitting there and she's heard reputations of Daisy's illicit dealings? So there was a lot of tension. They interviewed and polygraphed 87 people at the Kellogg's Corporation, fingerprinted, polygraphed, and interviewed them on this. So the implications were widespread. Even there were four poor boys who skipped school that day from Harper Creek High School. Can you imagine what a terrible day to skip school? The police show up at your house and they want to know where you were and what you saw.
So even with all of these people taking polygraph tests, even with witnesses actually looking at the killer, and there was never a lineup or there was never anybody who was a real good suspect?
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
There were some good suspects. My book is really the first time we've been able to reveal those because I used a Freedom of Information Act to really pry open the files and put it out there for the first time. There were several suspects over the years, but the primary one seemed to be the postman, William Daly. Mr. Daly was he gave a story the day of the crime that did not match some of the facts. He changed that story when they brought him back in 2 years later. He had a very distinctive hairstyle, parted down the middle and feathered back. Mm-hmm. 1963, the hairstyles were crew cut and a Princeton, and that was it.
That hairstyle would have fit in the 80s or the 70s, but yeah, that's interesting.
And he had the same style as the description of both of the men who had the eyewitness account of them. He threatened his daughter-in-law with bodily violence and said during that attack, "I know who killed Daisy Zick," which seems to be a very strange context. Mm. But the thing that struck my wife probably the most was he had been interviewed the day of this brutal crime. It was on TV. His wife had worked with Daisy at Kellogg's at one point. He didn't tell his wife even that he had been interviewed by the police.
So that's odd.
There's a lot of things that come up inconsistent. Now, the police finally zeroed in on him in 1967. They said, wait a minute. There was an officer, Leroy Steinbacher, who really crawled through this case and kind of breathed new life into it. He realized the inconsistencies, spotted those things. They brought in William Daly. His story didn't match up again. And they said, let's bring you back for a polygraph. He said, I'm going down to Florida for 2 weeks. And then when I'm back, I'll be happy to be polygraphed. He left and never came back.
They let him go.
Well, they didn't have an inconsistent story on a 3-year-old case at that point. It just wasn't enough to be able to have probable cause to hold him. And William Daly is the only person in the volumes of this file that was ever had the name suspect attached to it. And to let you know, the police, this became a generational thing. It was passed on from generation to generation of law enforcement officers. In 2001, they again went through the case file and they said they had heard a rumor that Mr. Daly was dying and in the hospital in Florida. They sent down a team of officers, including a polygrapher, realizing most of the witnesses are dead.
Right.
You could never bring these folks into court anyway at that point. They're in their 70s and 80s, and their testimony would be bad. They got down, said, all we want to do is get closure for the Zick family. You know, tell us, give us a polygraph, tell us what you know, and he refused.
He refused.
Turns out he wasn't dying at the time, but he did pass away just this last year.
When you think about, apart from people being called in and hauled in for a polygraph test, what that murder must have meant to the peace of mind to people in Battle Creek, can't even estimate it.
I have been shocked. Everywhere when I tell people I'm working on a book on the history of Battle Creek, if I'm vague about it, they always come up with two or three names and Daisy Zicks is at the top. And that, I don't go looking for books. They kind of look for me. And this is something that really stuck in Battle Creek's mind because there was such a level of brutality in this crime, and it seemed so random. And she was such a well-known and well-liked person, despite any of her lifestyle choices and things along those lines, that the fear was, wow, the killer could be my neighbor. It could be my coworker. And whoever it was never brought to justice.
Now, you've put a call out in your book. You kind of challenged the reading public. If anybody knows anything, here's your time. Have you heard from anyone? Have you gotten any leads?
Well, anything I get, I pass directly on to the police. I'm an author and a historian. My job is to tell stories. I'm not an investigator, but it's amazing. People will tell me things and never pick up the phone to tell the police. I have had numerous people reach out to me with, frankly, in some cases, some of the craziest theories. But, you know, the ones that are tangible, that have a chance of fitting the evidence, et cetera, I've passed those on to the police and they've taken a look at them. And I've had a few myself where I've gone through and said, wow, this person, you never looked at this person's fingerprints. What if this situation happened? And that was the case with the Cooley family. Albert Cooley had been brought in and interviewed about his potential relationship with Daisy Zick. He went and they said, let's arrange a polygraph. He agreed and went home that night and killed himself.
That's right.
Sure looks suspicious, you know. And they checked his fingerprints, but his brother several months later tried to kill himself. And I told the officers, well, maybe the brother was the one that was involved and Albert was worried about implicating him. So have you ever checked this set of fingerprints? And so things like that are where I've passed on information, and I've had a number of theories I've had to pass on to the police.
So from the perspective of 50 years out and look almost 51 years now looking back, what's your gut feeling as to why she was killed and the way she was killed?
Well, the way she was killed, I think, was bizarre on many – the crime scene doesn't tell you an accurate story. It doesn't tell you a consistent story. Some of her wounds indicate somebody was left-handed. Some indicate someone who was right-handed. Hard to tell. You know, the witness descriptions, I'm fairly certain, pointed to a man. If it was William Daly, chances are he was stalking her. He had admitted to several people he had seen Daisy Zick sunbathing nude. Now, I checked with some of the young boys who lived in that neighborhood and was told, yeah, it was a well-known thing. We would peek through the hedges and see Mrs. Zick in her backyard. Well, this is a rural postal carrier. He delivered from his car. The Zick house is set back a good 80 or 90 feet. I've been by it.
That would take some doing, wouldn't it?
There's hedges that surrounded it. How would he have seen Daisy sunbathing nude in the backyard? There's no way I could see where you could get that angle. And, you know, when you start looking at it, you start going for what may have been more simple. While people were looking for someone who was having an affair with Daisy, it may be that it was just a simple case of someone who was being stalked and was told no and couldn't deal with that rejection or something along those lines. You know, as well, there have been theories floated over the years that it could be a woman. In 1963, the concept of a woman doing such a savage and brutal crime didn't fit the public psyche, and it wasn't something the police were able to really wrap their hands around.
But sure.
In the 1990s, Gary Hogue, an investigator for the state police, said, well, what if it was a female that
somebody
we saw?
Unhappy with perhaps something going on with her husband. Who
right.
knows? What about Daisy's son?
Jim King is still very much alive with us, and I'm thankful for that. And when I worked on this, whenever you do these, it's always a sensitive moment as an author when you reach out to either the victim's family or, and if it's a case that's closed, the murderer's mm-hmm. family. And you never know what reaction you're going to get. Jim King was incredibly supportive. He really filled in the gaps to tell the story of Daisy's life, which I included in the book. But more importantly, I met him when I was doing a book signing for my other book, Secret Witness. He came by to drop off some pictures and so we could meet face to face. And I talked to him on the phone and emailed, and I saw him, and when he talked about his mother, I can't describe it any other way, but I saw a 13 or 14-year-old boy talking about his mother. The years disappeared. You know, the love that he had for his mother and the love I think that the whole family had for Daisy is still there. And to me, I said at that point, no matter what, this book's got to go out. We've got to find who did this. If nothing, it'll never go to trial. Even though all the evidence is still in the state police vaults, it's probably never going to trial, but they can close the case if they can get someone to come forward and say, I gave somebody a lift that day. Maybe it was a postman walking down the road and said,
sure.
I got to drop off a package and my car broke down. Or, gee, I gave a lift to somebody, you know, over by where the car was banned. Never dawned on me that they might be related to this crime. Someone else saw the killer. We had four or five people that saw that person that day. Somebody else had to have.
The book is Murder in Battle Creek, The Mysterious Death of Daisy Zick, and we've been speaking with the author, Blaine Pardo. Thanks for talking with us and coming in today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Finally, we're going to bring you a slightly different historical take on Motown. You know the Marvin Gaye and Martha Reeves song, Dancing in the Street? Yes, of course you do. If you're alive in America in the last 40 years, you know that song. Well, for a lot of people, that song represents Motown. But what a lot of people don't know is that this is a song that this historian, at least, believes changed Motown's history, changed Detroit's history, and maybe even changed America's history. Again, that author sat down with Stateside's Cynthia Canty.
For many, that song is Motown music. Dancing in the Street, written by Mickey Stevenson, Ivy Joe Hunter, and Marvin Gaye, and recorded in two takes, less than 10 minutes, by Martha Reeves. Well, little did they know, after slapping down Martha's vocals in that studio in Hitsville on West Grand Boulevard, that they'd created a song that would come to represent a watershed moment in history, Motown's history, Detroit's history, and America's history. Writer Mark Kurlansky tells us the story of how this hit Motown song became the rallying point for important moments in history. His newest book is called Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And Mark Kurlansky joins us now. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Nice to be talking to you.
Take us back, if you will, to that day in June 1964. Martha Reeves got on a bus and went from her home on Detroit's east side over to the west side where Hitsville was. And she wasn't even supposed to be recording that day, was she?
No. You know, Berry Gordy built Motown by grabbing all of these talented kids out of high school. And it should be remembered that the only reason this was possible because this was a day in which high schools, public high schools in poor urban neighborhoods had great music programs, most of which have been cut now.
Yes.
You know, so kids got out of high school, if they had musical talent, you know, they not only knew how to sing or play instruments, but they could read music, they understood music theory, they understood how harmony worked. And they would try to, you know, somehow get a foot in at Hitsville, Motown, and they'd go over to the studio, and you know, if you hung out there, good things happened. You know, sooner or later, Diane Ross got her start. You know, someday somebody's going to say, "Hey, you try this."
Yeah.
And you know, she was over there just doing what the young talent did over there, and she heard that Marvin Gaye was recording a new song called Dancing in the Street. And she didn't think much of that title. She told me that she would have much rather done a song about dancing in an elegant ballroom. I mean, that's Martha, you know.
Yes, we know her. So she hears about, you know, Marvin's in the studio, and she had a little crush on him anyway, didn't she?
I think she always had a crush on him, and she started singing backup for him. So she went into Studio A there to see what he was up to. And Marvin Gaye saw her and said to Mickey Stevenson, "Hey, why don't we let Martha do this?" Just like that, you know. And you know, 50 years later, Martha still remembers this as the moment when Marvin Gaye handed her the song.
Wow.
That wasn't it at all. That was happening.
What was happening?
The three of them had written the song in the home of Mickey Stevenson and his wife,
Kim Weston. Yeah.
And the song was for Kim. And they always used to make a demo tape for the artist to listen to for a while before their recording session. And they were just there trying to make a demo tape. And it occurred to Marvin Gaye that a demo tape for Kim with Martha singing would be a lot better than with him singing. Because it wasn't really his kind of thing. I mean, he wrote it, but it wasn't the kind of song that he sang.
Right.
But then after she sang it, she just so nailed it that they just couldn't imagine anybody else singing it, which was, of course, a huge problem for Mickey Stevenson, who had promised it to his wife.
And she really nailed it in two takes, correct? One, they said they weren't rolling, although that's not
this
real
was
clear.
Another thing that they never told her.
Yeah.
So I was sitting in Martha's old house in the living room there on the east side, and she's sitting to the right of me, and Ivy Joe Hunter is sitting to my left, and we're talking about this, and she's telling me this old story that she's told 100 times that everybody knows about how she sang it, and then they told her that they messed up and failed to record it, so she had to sing it again. So I sort of asked the obvious question. You know, I used to be a reporter. You know? the question that sort of hangs there is, which take was better? You know, because the other take is lost now. So I wondered, you know, was that really a you know, did we miss the really great one? And she was starting to answer, and then I hear Ivy over to my left say, look at me. I turn around, and he says, you've got this young artist, and she does this take, and you think, well, it's not quite there. She can do better than that. So do you say that, or do you say, oh, gee, I'm sorry, I didn't record it. Can we do it again?
How to handle an artist.
And Martha, you know, her jaw dropped open. Nobody had ever told her that. She had always believed the story that, you know, it hadn't been recorded.
That's a great story. You know, you explain in your book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, how the rhythm and blues of the 50s was really targeted at black audiences. And before that, black music had come out of slavery. And as you point out, Mark, whites had swing, blacks had R&B. Now, take us up to that summer of 64 and give us a sense, what was the position of black music and black artists in that summer?
Yeah. So, you know, the bulk of the African-American population of the United States was rural and southern. And then in the first part of the 20th century, they started moving north. And by mid-century, the bulk of the population was northern and urban. So that, of course, changed the music. So instead of having rural blues and gospel, you had a music with a much harder beat, electric instruments, and it was called rhythm and blues. And rhythm and blues was black music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, black music and white music were completely separate, made by different people, different record companies, sold in different record stores, played on different radio stations with different DJs, and, you know, so different that Billboard charts had a black chart and a white chart.
Right.
The black chart was called the R&B chart. That's what R&B meant. And then, you know, this idea started emerging of integration. And a lot of white people, obviously not all, but a lot of white people, especially young white people, thought this was a pretty great idea. And those young white people, the white people who were interested in the idea of integration, very logically started getting interested in black culture. That meant black music. And they started listening to R&B. And then, of course, you had, you know, rebellious, bad white boys from the South who went to the wrong side of town and learned the music and learned the vocalization and the clothes and the dance moves. And, you
yes.
know, and you get Elvis Presley and
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Right.
Yes.
And so, you know, now there's a white R&B world, and Alan Freed, the great promoter of rock and roll, originally a Cleveland DJ and then New York, invented the term rock and roll because he didn't like it. It was sort of a problem. If you said rhythm and blues, it meant music for black people.
Mm-hmm.
So rock and roll meant R&B for white people. And, of course, this was all very interesting for people like Barry Gordy, black people in the music industry, because the white market was about 8 times the size of the black market.
A lot of money to be made.
Yeah.
By the time we're looking at that summer in 64, you had that whole issue of the British invasion and all these Brits who had grown up worshiping black R&B artists.
You know, with all of this controversy and trouble that people got into, rock and roll hit a period when it was said to be dead. It actually wasn't dead. I mean, there were actually a number of really great performers, but it wasn't as hot as it had been in the 50s. And it was in that period that the British started taking up the slack. They had loved the old rock and roll, and you know, people like the Beatles and Mick Jagger and, you know, said, well, what's happened? It sort of died. So they started doing it. And, 1964 was the year that both the Beatles and Rolling Stones first came to America.
Yes.
And really, the only thing, if you look at the charts in those days, they were completely dominated by either British groups or Motown.
They were. I remember vividly from I've kept the music guides from the station I listened to as I grew up here in Detroit. I'm speaking with writer Mark Kurlansky, whose book, Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America, looking at that hit, Martha and the Vandellas' Motown song, and how it became the rallying point for some very important moments in history. When you talk about that summer of 64 and then the year or so after as that song just became a giant hit, Give us a sense, a snapshot of what was happening politically and socially in America, because it just was, it's mind-boggling when you look back and realize.
It is. I have an appendix in the back of the book just listing what happened in the summer of 64. It's unbelievable. The song came out July 31st. 2 days later, the Vietnam War officially began. The first of hundreds of black inner-city uprisings took place in Harlem a couple of weeks before the song.
The Civil Rights Act was passed?
It was the heart of the Mississippi Freedom Summer.
Yes.
And Goodman and Cheney and Schwarmer had disappeared, mm-hmm. and the front page of the paper every day was about the search for their bodies. It was a presidential election year, and people forget how important an election year it was. Goldwater Johnson completely changed the nature of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and the nature of American politics. You know, that whole red state, blue state map completely changed in 64. Mm-hmm. So it was an extremely significant summer politically. But, you know, one of the big changes was these uprisings that started to happen every summer in every urban area with an important black community.
We got ours in Detroit in 1967.
Absolutely. In 1967, yeah, I mean, Detroit was one of the big ones. But, you know, there were 120 of them just in the summer of 1967. And, you know, here is this song that says, you know, first it has this very strong black voice, this trumpet call and the strong voice saying, calling out around the world.
Yeah.
And are you ready for a brand new beat? Summer is here and the time is right for dancing in the streets. What's that supposed to mean? And then they're dancing in Chicago, and it starts listing all of these cities which had large, volatile black communities. And by the way, Marvin Gaye was the one who did the list, except for Detroit.
Hmm.
He was listing all the cities, and Ivy Joe Hunter said, "Hey, don't forget the Motor City."
And that went
into the song exactly like that. Don't forget the Motor City.
But Martha always insisted, didn't she, that that song was about a street party and having a good time. And so who began?
Absolutely, and I have no doubt that to her it was.
Okay. What about to the writers? What about to Stevenson and Marvin Gaye and
Well,
and
you know,
Joe
Gaye
Hunter?
Would have been interesting. He of course, died years
yes.
ago, killed by his father.
Yes.
But, you know, Gaye was very political, and he's the one who, for years, had this argument with Berry Gordy, his brother-in-law, saying that, you know, Motown can't just be about love and heartache. We've got to take on these issues. These are important issues, and we're going to be irrelevant if we don't take them on.
So was this a case of what was often something that happened in black music called masking?
Well, quite possibly. You know, this was a very old, strong tradition in black music, so much so that, you know, when black people hear a song, the first thing they do is try to figure out what the real meaning is.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mickey Stevenson told me that the origin of the song was he was driving around in Detroit one day with Marvin Gaye, and they saw a bunch of kids, black and white, playing in, this was in the summertime on a hot day, and they were playing with a fire hydrant. And to him, this song was about integration.
Hmm.
So Mickey Stevenson did see a political meaning to the song, although not the one that's usually ascribed to it. So it's, you know, it's very difficult. And also, don't forget that the whole concept of masking, the whole tradition of masking is that you never admit it. You know,
That's true.
You know, like follow the drinking gourd. You don't say, yes, this was actually about the Underground Railroad and escaping to the North. You know?
Sure.
So we might never know. But, you know, clearly in talking to Mickey Stevenson, I had the impression that, you know, there certainly were intended political undercurrents. But
and it's worth noting, isn't it, that after 9/11, broadcasting giant Clear Channel put Dancing in the Streets on a list of songs its radio stations, many of them, should not play.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? 2001, and it was still considered a dangerous song to play at a difficult moment.
Yeah, I do remember that. So how is Martha, as you talk with her, or Mickey, how are they about the fact that that song has come to embody the spirit of revolution for blacks, and then later for women in the early 70s.
Yeah, Sarah Dash, who sang it with Patti LaBelle and Laura Nyro, said that, you know, as far as she was concerned, it was a song about emerging feminism. But I kind of got the feeling that Mickey Stevenson liked all this. Martha does not. Dating back to 1967, even before that at Watts, you know, they used to say that this song was inspiring, you know, was causing people to riot. This, of course, was white people saying this.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a kind of a racist thing that, you know, black people just sit around in their lackadaisical way, but then along comes the song, and then they go out on the street and start burning down buildings. It's an absurd concept. But, you know, there were a lot of people who genuinely believed that, you know, this song inspired people to riot. And this was pretty upsetting to Martha, who doesn't like violence. And she was asked at a press conference in 67 if she had inspired the Detroit and Newark riots. And she still almost comes to tears when she talks about it. You know, she doesn't want to be held responsible for these things.
What drew you to this song? What made you go to all of this and dig into this and write this book?
Well, it was a great opportunity to get at a few things I wanted to talk about that don't get talked about enough. One being how the struggle for black rights completely changed American music. And, you know, it would have been totally different without it. There wouldn't have been rock and roll without it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that it shows the importance of a song. You know, this song was one of 50 songs that's in the U.S. National Archive of great songs that are iconic to American culture. And, you know, it shows, partly by, you know, just enduring, it shows the importance of a song. Songs tell us all about who we are, what we came from, and what we aspire to be. And I thought this was a great time to think about that.
The book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. And I've been speaking with the author, Mark Kurlansky. Thanks so much for your time today, Mark.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
All right, folks, that is it for Art Pod this week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Kate Wells, and until next time, go ahead, leave us a comment, tell us what you want us to be covering, what's going on in your neck of the woods. You can do all of that at michiganradio.org, and thanks.